Well, welcome everyone. Welcome to this course, to this exploration, to this inquiry into the experience, the lived experience of no self. And more importantly, really life, life beyond self. Before we get going, I want to, there are people from 35 countries that are participating in this course that are listening right now. And I thought at the beginning of each evening I would just mention a few of them, because if I went through the list, take me a few minutes to do it. But there are people from Australia. In fact, there's a name or two from each country that I might mention. Of course, there's most countries have many people listening. John from Australia and Garrett from Belgium, Cynthia from Brazil, Catalina from Canada, Veronica from Chile, Helena from the Czech Republic, Kirsten from Denmark, Zoe from France, Rami from Finland, and many, many more. As I say at the beginning of each program, I might mention a few names from the different countries that are participating in this. And this shows me the real profound interest in this subject. Do you know, a few years ago, I received a kind of understanding that one of the most important things for me to bring forth in my role as a teacher in this teaching was to really bring forth some clarity into the whole realm of life beyond self and the experience of no self, that I realize that this is a very important part of my teaching work. It's probably the most challenging part of the teaching work, not only for those who participate in it, those who are listening, those who are studying it, I guess you'd say, but also for myself as well. It's definitely the most challenging part of the spiritual journey to verbalize, to give voice to. Do you know, in the spiritual marketplace today, the idea, the notion of no self is you know, bandied about, and I think it's often talked about in a way that is, I think, doesn't do it justice, actually. That's kind of casual, hip, you might say, in the sense of being modern. But often I feel like it really misses the mark. A lot of the talk and the discussion around no self is actually much more about the idea of no self, the philosophy of it, the theology of no self. And I'm not interested in any of that. None of that. I'm not interested in exploring this subject in a casual way, or a theological way, or a philosophical way. I'm only interested in exploring this in an experiential way. And this is very important to recognize. Because as I said, most of what we hear about it is really a kind of a philosophy of no self. And often it's not a very well-developed philosophy. A sort of modernized theology of no self. And often this comes out of perhaps glimpses of a moment beyond self, maybe more. But there's a great difference between a moment of self-transcendence and the actual lived experience of no self. And so I want to bring some clarity to some of these issues to start this course off with. And as I said, it's challenging for me to give voice to these, to talk about these. It's very hard to find the language. It's challenging to find the correct language. And it's also, I think we'll be going into realms that are quite subtle and quite profound, and yet require a real focus, a real, real, real focus. And probably this evening, to be quite honest, this evening may be the most difficult of them all, the most difficult of all, because I really want to start by really jumping into the deep end of this whole subject. As I said, I don't want to talk about this in a casual way or a philosophical way. Often it's talked about in one of those two ways. You know, we have a lot of talk about no self and sort of Vedic circles of teaching. But I often what I hear or what I read about is much more philosophical and very far removed, I think, from the actual experience. It doesn't do justice, a lot of what's out there, to the real lived experience of it. There's nothing casual about the lived experience of it. There's nothing actually philosophical about it. It's very concrete. It's very obvious. It's very profound. And so I want to look at it this way. And even when it's talked about in a sophisticated way, often it becomes philosophical. Do you know, in the religion that I did most of my spiritual training in Zen Buddhism, you know, in Buddhism there is some talk about no self, but it's often talking about, again, even though this philosophy arises out of the Buddha's direct experience of no self, and others also experience of no self. But often the teachings come off as very, very philosophical, you know, even in a simple sense of one of the central teachings of no self in Buddhism is that all things, whether it's you, whether it's a rock, a chair, a tree, a car, that nothing has a sort of self-essence. That, in other words, if you break things down into its constituent parts, that everything is sort of an assemblage of different parts. And if you pull all the parts together, you don't find some substantial kind of entity in the center of them. In other words, if you remove the ground and the sky and the rain and the various elements that make up something like a tree, if you remove each one of those elements, you take the ground away and the chemical composition and each piece that you start to peel away, you realize there's no actual thing called a tree inside of it. It's all these constituent parts coming together that we call a tree. But that's, once again, that's, it may be true, but it's essentially, it's philosophical, and I don't think it really gets to the heart of the matter, and it certainly doesn't touch deeply upon people's actual lived experience of what no self is really all about. And that's what I'm interested in this course. I'm not, as I said, I'm not interested in presenting this philosophically or theologically. There's plenty of that that's done. I'm really looking at this from an experiential standpoint. And, of course, all this is derived from my own experience, and it's also derived from experiences of seeing others that I've witnessed go through this. So another reason that I feel compelled to bring this teaching forth, I've been talking about it at various times over the last few years, here and there, developing how I was going to teach about it. It's kind of an ongoing process of finding the right terminology, of finding ways to explain the subtleties of what this no-self experience really is all about. And so that's been, has its own challenge to it. But like I said, it became obvious to me some years ago that this was really a very important thing that I was to bring forth, that it was really a very important part of the teaching that I was really supposed to convey. And I think part of that is that this experience, which is beyond an experience, but we'll start with the word experience to begin with, that this experience is starting to break into human consciousness. It's still relatively rare, quite rare actually, but it's not nearly as rare as it was 100 years ago or 500 or 1,000 years ago, that this is beginning to break into human consciousness, and it's beginning to, at least the beginnings of it, are happening to people of all strata of society, to spiritual people, to people that have no interest in spirituality at all, to all different stratas of human beings. And this is another reason why I think it's important to bring forth, because there's obviously a kind of, this is a time when this experience, at least in its seed form, is starting to break into human consciousness. It's becoming more common, although not entirely common, it's becoming a bit more common. And I want to make a distinction to begin with. And I think this is one of the most misunderstood or simply not understood parts of this whole subject, is that the experience of transcending self or transcending ego is one experience. It shows you, because you experience it, for those who've had the experience, when you transcend ego and you transcend self, either one of those, which I'll talk about what I mean by those in a moment, but it shows you through your own direct experience that there is a reality. There is a dimension of being, of existence, beyond self, beyond ego. That's what it shows you. That's what you know. And that experience and that knowing that comes from that experience, it alters you. It alters your view of yourself. It alters your view of life. It alters your view of existence. To transcend ego or to transcend self is not necessarily the same as no self. No self is not a transcendent, momentary experience. No self really, the term as I use it, applies to a permanent cessation of self. But often we have these experiences, these points where we flash forward, as it were, where we transcend self or ego altogether, and we experience for a moment that view, right? Often people don't stay there, or they don't stay there entirely. Often you can transcend ego, but because you transcended it, that doesn't mean it disappears necessarily. As many people that are listening to this program, that are listening to me talk right now, many of you have had the experience of completely transcending your egoic of identity, only to have your egoic identity re-arise to some extent. Any moment of transcendence is a kind of a mortal blow to the ego. In other words, it begins the ego's demise in a very profound way. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the ego disappears because you've transcended it. So there's a great distinction between a moment of transcendence, to transcend something, and to have something fall away. To transcend ego is not the same as to have ego fall away. To transcend self is not the same as to have self fall away. I hope to make this kind of distinction a little bit more clear as we go on, but I want to say something too before I go farther, is that it was interesting when we got some of the emails, you know, before the course even began, even when people were signing up, some people were wondering, will this subject matter pertain to me? I'm not so sure that it will, and some people didn't really know if what I'd be talking about would correspond to something they could understand or their experience, and I hadn't really had those kind of inquiries in the other courses I've done. And of course, the honest answer to that is, you know, you never know for sure what's going to correspond with someone's experience. But I think during these next 4 weeks that no matter what your experience is, I think you will find elements of this course, I hope, to be quite helpful and to be quite relevant. All of the course is not going to be relevant to everybody. In fact, to very few people will the entirety of this course be relevant to all that many people. But I think there'll be certain parts of it that'll be very, very relevant and meaningful, and I hope useful as well. And to simply look into this in a deep way, in an honest way, I think is helps one's spiritual maturity. Anyhow, sometimes it's useful to have some knowledge of what may be coming later, because then when it comes, at least you have some idea of what it's all about. So that's all a way of saying that I hope this course is relevant to all of you in some way. But like I said, I also understand that parts of this will be probably quite challenging. And some of the depth that I want to explore this in will be quite challenging. In other words, simply to follow, to really listen in a way that's that really where you're really present may be quite challenging, because, as I said, there's this notion of no self is out there in the spiritual culture, different spiritual cultures right now. And, you know, even when you bring up the very subject of no self, there's all these sort of corollary philosophical issues that tend to sidetrack people. Of course, I understand why they sidetrack people. I used to be quite interested in them in myself for a while. But there's all these sort of questions, philosophical kind of questions, that come out of the very notion of no self, you know. Simple things. You know, if there's no self, then there's no doer, then who does whatever you're going to do? If there's no self, then is there free will? Is there no free will? You know, because there must be a self there to have free will. And if there's no self, does that mean there's no free will? And not that these kind of inquiries are without usefulness, without merit, because they do have a certain usefulness. But they do not get to the heart of the issue. In fact, if you stay in these kind of inquiries, they keep you sort of running around the periphery of what the direct experience of no-self really is. The direct experience of no-self is about as far away from all the philosophical wonderings and quandaries about no-self as, you know, sitting in your room thinking about the sun is different from the actual sun itself. You know, you can sit in your room and think about the sun, but it doesn't make you warm. Thinking about the sun has nothing to do with the sun. Thinking about no self has very little, if anything, to do with actual lived experience. So this is also part of the challenge, is when we're looking into this, that we don't succumb too quickly or too often to all the sort of corollary philosophical questions that the mind can occupy itself with, which is actually often boils down to a very sophisticated means of holding on to self, even while as you're talking about the various philosophical issues that are involved in no self. So I'll say this over and over again, I suppose, but we're really looking at this from an experiential point of view. Even though the experience of no self ultimately brings one beyond experience, I think you get the idea when I say I want to talk about this, and I want to approach this whole idea quite experientially. Now, I think there's a few concepts that really help in the understanding of this, and actually help with the understanding of the whole of one's spiritual unfolding to begin with. And that is, we hear lots of words bantied about, like ego. What is ego? What is ego? Ego is actually something very simple. You know, there's many, many different definitions of ego. But in the sense, in the context that I'm using the term, ego is simply self-concern, self-obsession, to be identified with one's inner psychology. The psychology meaning all the self-referencing ideas, thoughts, opinions, judgments, storylines, all of that. And so when I say ego is a kind of self-obsession, I'm not saying that in a way that's judgmental of it. I'm not saying it's wrong, that one shouldn't do it, that you should, you know, look down at it. I'm just simply defining it as what it is. There's no judgment in this, you see. Ego is simply the act of consciousness being obsessed with the inner psychology. That's basically what ego is. A very immature ego is completely obsessed with their own self-concern. In other words, everything is filtered. In an immature ego, everything is filtered into this, how is this for me? How is this working for me? What do I think about this? What's my judgment about this, my judgment about that? Everything becomes filtered through the ego, through the act of self-concern. So, again, ego is to identify with one's inner psychology. And more specifically, ego is the act of being trapped in an identity, in a worldview, where one's self-concern is predominant, right? And that's basically almost where everybody starts out in their ego development. There is much self-concern. You know, what I want is very, very is the most important thing. You know, of course, in a mature ego, in a very healthy, mature, less divided ego, because all ego has a kind of division to it. But in a mature ego, the ego starts to reach out beyond its own self-obsession, and it starts to reach out and be concerned or truly care, have a feeling for something beyond itself, right? That could be, you know, it could start off a very small concern beyond yourself, your own loved ones, your family. Then it can go a little bit wider, your local community, your religious, people in your religion maybe. Then it can go to your culture, maybe your country. Then it can go to something vaster, humanity at large. So as an ego matures, it starts to outgrow and relinquish this obsessive self-concern, and its orientation becomes not completely fixated in its own psychology, its own story. Now, a ego in its, I guess you'd say, in its highest sense, its highest desire, in other words, because in a certain sense, ego is the act, the verb of desire, craving, wanting, and aversion, pushing away, rejecting. I don't want that. I do want this. This is the movement of ego, right? This is not what ego's doing. This is what ego is. And this contributes to the self-centered orientation, right? So when we're, you know, it's kind of like when you're a teenager, perhaps, or younger, you know, you get part of what teenagers go through is a sort of obsessive self-concern. You know, the way their hair is parted becomes all important. Every day they get up and they, you know, they're worried about how they fit into their social group and what they're wearing, and you know, all of this becomes sort of hyper important to the exclusion of many, many other things in life. Of course, a lot of people live their entire life in that state. That's almost a state of normalcy, actually. in most societies, some version of that. And the ego's, when the ego gets to its higher, more mature form, as I said, it starts to reach out to something other than its own self. It becomes more altruistic, in other words. And when it really starts to touch upon its own depth, then it starts to turn in a way where it reaches towards that which is truly beyond itself. We could call that the infinite. We could call that God. Whatever word you want to give to that which entirely transcends ego. So ego is basically self-centered concern in its immature aspect. Often when you undertake different kinds of spirituality, different kinds of spirituality are meant to loosen up that adherence, that boundedness to ego. And I think everybody that's probably listening to knows the experience of being feeling very bounded in ego when you're in a state of great suffering, because all this ego orientation is the cause of the vast majority of suffering that people experience. And so when we're really bound in the ego, there's a feeling of being feeling bound and encased and enclosed and small and isolated. That's when we feel very, very much tightly bound to the ego, right? So spirituality, in one sense, it's at least initially, is to try to let go of being so bound. Of course, you open up to something bigger, whether it's tapping into the higher ego's morality, which is the concern of all beings, the welfare of all life, you could say, or it could be tapping into a love of God, or it could tap into a kind of existential question. What is reality? What is really true? These are all ways of actually you're having your concern not be completely introverted, and now it goes and it looks for a deeper truth than itself. That's actually a very high function of the ego. It's its higher function, to go in search of a truth, a reality, other than its own self-concern and self-obsession. That's the ego being more in touch with its more mature aspect. And spirituality helps one to do that. There's all kinds of means of going about that, from prayer to meditation to spiritual inquiry, you know, to selfless service. There's many, many means to go to try to loosen this sort of self-obsession. Of course, the ego is a very mercurial verb, is a mercurial movement of consciousness. It often keeps forming itself into new identities, you know. So you think, well, you get involved in spirituality, and well, I'm no longer just a isolated human being. So now but the ego takes on a deeper identification. So now your identification becomes maybe more the a religious group. Now you're a Buddhist or a Christian or a Jew any of the other Hindu. The ego re-identifies with a spiritual identity. And so the ego can play almost any game you can imagine. It's very mercurial. It's very moldable. And one of the tendencies of it keeps turning itself into new forms all the time until we start to develop a kind of wisdom, until we start to become familiar with the ways that the ego turns itself into. It's like I call it a shapeshifter. It shifts shapes. If you see it in one shape, it just shifts into another. And then you see it in that shape and it shifts into another. But at a certain point, you start to see the whole movement of ego. Something deeper in you starts to recognize it. Now, I'm going to use it. These two terms I'm going to use a number of times, which is one is ego and the other is self. I'm going to use them as if they're two different things. In a certain sense, they are, and in a certain sense, they aren't, right? Both ego and self are forms of consciousness. Ego is a form of consciousness. It's consciousness obsessed with its own self-concern. Self, and this is a little harder to really understand, but self is actually the act of self-consciousness is what self is. So the definition of what self is, it is the act of self-consciousness. Self-consciousness is a kind of looking within. It's a kind of looking within. It's maybe not a looking within in the same sense that we think of spirituality as looking within, although it is the same, but spirituality kind of uses looking within and really focuses as it and brings it into sort of a one-pointedness. But self is self-consciousness. Self is the act of self-consciousness. Ego is what self-consciousness reflects upon. When it looks in, what this self or self-consciousness sees and experiences in its center, in its own inner personal psychology, is what we call ego. Now, when you have a moment of going beyond ego, beyond that egoic identity, thinking, feeling that inner psychology is you, when you have a deep experience of going beyond it, a transcendent experience, all of a sudden you feel yourself, you know yourself not to be the ego. The ego may be there, but you know that it doesn't really define you. And in other words, when you go to a deeper dimension of experience, a wider dimension, you could think metaphorically, then what completely identified you and defined you now is seen within a bigger dimension from a bigger point of view. And now you see that what you thought defined you is actually not what you are, but it's something that simply exists within you. You have to transcend or get beyond the ego to realize that the ego is simply something that exists within experience, within you, but it is not you. This kind of experience is often very profound. It often feels very, very freeing, very liberating. It's kind of like an aha, you know? I thought I was the person I thought I was. I thought that's who I was. I thought what I thought and what I felt and what I imagined and all my judgments and opinions, I thought that all that was me, was who I was. And even worse than that, I thought all that was true. And with a moment of transcending it, you realize a bigger dimension of experience. And now all that you thought you were is something that exists inside of you, within you, you might say. So you've awoken at that moment to a deeper dimension of being. As some of you know, when you have that kind of experience, it can be something that's permanent. It often isn't. It often feels like you transcend ego, and for a while it can seem like the ego's completely non-functional. You can be in a complete state of flow, which is what it feels like not to be trapped in ego. It feels like flow and a certain kind of ease and a certain lack of self-consciousness, a lack of egoic consciousness, actually. And that feels very easy and flowing and open and free and dynamic in a certain sense and vital and also quiet and simple. And quite beautiful. And for a while, since that experience, that revelation, may be in some instances quite overwhelming, overpowering, it may seem like the ego is completely gone. But in many instances, probably most, some amount of the egoic structure will automatically, literally automatically, start to try to put itself back together. It can never put itself back together in the same completeness once you've seen through it. But it differs from one individual to the other, how much the ego kind of holds, puts itself back together. One of the ways the ego puts itself back together is to try to hold on to a moment of spiritual revelation. In other words, to try to hold on to a moment of awakening. And the ego says, I want this, I don't want to lose this. And the ego, as soon as you think, I don't want to lose this, that is an egoic thought. It's egoic self-concern. It may be the concern of losing a wonderful, beautiful experience, but essentially, it's still self-concern. And as soon as there's self-concern, as soon as you get at all concerned with losing something, you contract. You start to grasp at what you don't want to lose. Of course, as soon as you grasp at it, your grasping solidifies the experience of ego. You can't actually lose the deeper dimension of being, but you can succumb to the ego recontracting upon itself. And then, of course, you will long for what you experienced, what you realized. Part of that, part of the journey will be realizing that in order to get out beyond the ego again, you have to stop grasping at even the revelation. See, any kind of grasping is still egoic grasping. Spiritual grasping, grasping at spiritual experiences, at revelations, of all that, that is still, it's still grasping, and it's still egoically centered. Only ego grasps at experience. Whether they're happy, sad, mundane, lovely, awful, spiritual, transcendent, mind-blowing, if that which grasps at those is ego. Those experiences aren't grasping at themselves. The dimension that's revealed in those experiences is not grasping. What would it grasp at? It knows it can't lose itself. It's like your feet don't grasp at themselves in fear that they'll lose themselves. Your hand doesn't try to clutch itself in fear that it's going to lose itself. From that dimension of experience, that dimension of being, it's never grasping itself. It's only ego that sees itself as other than, and therefore tries to sustain that experience or possess it or own it, that grasps. So all grasping, no matter what kind of grasping, no matter what level the grasping is happening at, is essentially a kind of egoic activity. Again, this isn't to judge it or to make it wrong or to condemn it. It's just saying, calling it what it is. Now, at some point, this grasping and pushing away, which is really what ego is. Ego is a verb, right? It's a movement of consciousness. It's a form that consciousness takes. There's no entity in there called an ego. Ego is a particular form that consciousness takes. Why it takes that form, that's one of those philosophical questions that keeps you spinning and on the periphery of experience and never diving in. Most questions will keep you spinning on the periphery of something much more profound. So it's not really useful to ask why in this regard. Now, so there's the transcendence of ego, and then there's falling away of ego. Falling away of ego would mean that grasping at all its levels and the pushing away at all of its levels ceases. People think of the non-egoic state, when there's no ego, they think of it in all sorts of ridiculous ways, that the person then will have a beatific smile, they'll look this way, they'll act exactly this way, they'll be a saint, they'll be, you know, all these ridiculous notions, which are just literally imagined by the ego, because the ego cannot imagine anything beyond its own domain. It literally cannot do it. It tries. It thinks it knows what it's imagining. It thinks it knows, but it doesn't, and it can't know anything beyond its own domain. So all the ideas that the mind or ego has of what this state beyond ego is going to look like are just egoic ideas. That life beyond ego, even though it might start out as feeling quite unusual or even extraordinary, actually becomes something that's very, very simple. Very, very simple. It even matures into a kind of ordinariness because it is simply the way things are. And no one around you may have any idea of what's happened for you at all. You will not go around with a halo over your head or people bowing at your feet. Most people, if not all people, will have no idea what's happened for you, within you, to you. None whatsoever. The nice thing is, when the ego drops away, there will be nothing in you that cares. Nothing in you that wants anyone to recognize it. Nothing in you that even thinks, does someone notice about what's going on with me? Does anybody understand it? Do they recognize it? Do they appreciate it? All of that is remnant of ego concern. Because it's self-concern. It may be a high-level self-concern, but it's self-concern nonetheless. When ego falls away, all that concern disappears with it. It doesn't matter a hoot if anybody ever knew what happened for you. It doesn't matter if you never told anybody about it. None of it matters anymore when ego falls away. And you don't actually become more extraordinary, you simply become more simple. This doesn't mean you lose your capacity to know what the right thing to do is. This doesn't mean that you do not have the ability to feel certain emotions. You can still feel any emotion. This doesn't mean you lose the ability to say no or yes. Again, the problem with a lot of these of spirituality is our egoic minds continue to insist that they can understand something that's beyond themselves, and they just cannot really let in that we cannot understand something beyond our current state of development. We cannot. We can think we do, but we cannot. And only when we go beyond it, then we realize, actually, I knew nothing about it. I might have thought I was an expert, but I actually wasn't. I didn't know the slightest thing about it. I thought I did, but once you get there, you realize you didn't. That it was all folly, that it was actually a kind of defense mechanism against your own unfolding. Hence, spiritual teachers for, gosh, long as they've been talking probably, have been suggesting to people to let go of what you think you know, and especially the spiritual knowledge. Don't worry about what's around the next corner, what's the deeper dimension of experience. Because thinking that we know is a defense against realizing it. And so the spiritual instruction is often to, you know, let yourself just live in the unknown. In other words, don't try to know something beyond what you currently do. I don't mean don't try to know it in the sense of don't try to realize it, but I mean don't pretend that you can know anything about something that you have not yet actually experienced. Because we can't. So when you transcend ego, of course, there's a sense of relief. You feel the constriction, the friction, which is ego, wanting, and I want and I don't want, right? Aversion and desire. These two that create a friction inside, as well as the self-images, the self-ideas about ourselves, about others, about the world, about, you know, am I good, am I bad, am I right, am I wrong, am I worthy, and am I unworthy? You know, all this is all conflicted emotional turmoil. When we see that there's actually no self in it, and we've connected with a much deeper impulse within ourselves, any moment that you even transcend it, all of a sudden there's a feeling of interior unification, a smoothness, a flow, a sense of a lack of anxiety, a lack of a kind of boundedness. And when the ego drops away, that sense of boundedness drops away with it. Psychological boundedness. Now, one of the great, I think, at least as I see it, mistakes that's often made in a lot of spirituality that I hear, especially modern day stuff, is that the experience of transcendence of ego is... Number one, it's mistaken for the falling away of ego. And even worse than that, that the transcendence of ego is mistaken for the falling away of self. And they're completely and absolutely different things, although they're often talked about as if they were the same thing. If the transcendence of ego is not the same thing as the falling away of ego, then the transcendence of ego certainly isn't going to be the falling away of self. So far we've looked at the transcendence of ego, momentary or permanent, and then there's the transcendence of self. As I said, this is more difficult to even get a conceptual understanding. Remember, I'm talking from an experiential point of view. I'm not turning this into a philosophy or a theology. Very important to realize. Even though I may say things that make it sound like that, that's not my intention. I'm talking purely from the experiential reality of this. So whereas ego can be defined in a few different ways, you know, ego can be defined as desire and aversion. Ego can be defined as an obsession with one's own psychology. And ego is essentially a kind of friction to some extent. Self is that which looks at ego. So when self is obsessed, self being the act, the verb, not the thing. There's not a thing called a self. There's not a someone called a self. Self is the act of consciousness reflecting within. And we call that self-consciousness. Self-consciousness can take many, many different forms. When we're in the egoic state of consciousness, what we're almost continuously involved with is self-consciousness. The act of looking within is completely obsessed with ego, right? So when there's the ego falls away, which the transcendence of ego, well, let's put it this way, the falling away of ego is often precipitated with the feeling of almost a kind of death. Because the ego doesn't have to die to transcend it. It doesn't have to do anything to transcend it. That's kind of the nice thing about it. That's actually one of the access points to transcending your ego, is stop trying to do anything about it. You're obsessively trying to do everything about your ego is actually what keeps you bound to it. So when you stop all that, even for a moment, then consciousness can go beyond it. It can transcend it. Which there's an innate fear of that within the ego, because the ego can only, since it can't know anything beyond itself, the only thing it can feel, experience as anything beyond itself is its own non-existence, because of course the ego doesn't exist beyond itself. So of course when consciousness starts to move beyond the ego, even gets to the boundary of the ego, of course the ego is going to feel, literally, experientially feel the fear, the terror, that it's going to die. It's not so much that it dies as that it cannot know what's beyond itself. It, the ego, can't go beyond itself. So in a certain sense, when you go beyond the ego, it's a kind of death to the ego. When the ego falls to transcend, it kind of is one kind of fear. When the ego really finally collapses, that's also precipitated often with a kind of fear. Not always, but very often, a kind of fear of, if there's a complete letting go, there's this almost irrational feel like you'll be annihilated. You'll just disappear into this awful, terrible, feelingless, pitiful void. And of course, all of this has nothing to do with what's beyond ego. It has everything to do with what ego imagines is beyond itself. Since it can't imagine anything beyond itself, it can only conclude that it's a kind of annihilation. But that's all the ego's doing, and that has nothing to do with beyond ego. Fortunately, since you are not ego, essentially, that one can always go beyond it. When the ego dies, the ego can go into sort of a death scream, but when we're ready, it just sort of happens. It's a grace. It's not the ego can't make its own disappearance happen. It just can't do it. In fact, the ego has to stop trying to lead one's own spiritual life. It has to stop trying to make everything happen for it to fall away. The ego can't get rid of itself any more than your foot can outrun itself. Do you know? It just doesn't work that way. It has to just cease even its effort to get beyond itself. Because ego's efforts to get beyond itself is another act of self-concern, self-obsession. And to relinquish that is a very scary thing often for ego. Disorienting. And so it tends to clutch until it's ready to not clutch. When it's ready to not clutch, it just doesn't clutch anymore. You as an ego don't do it. When the ego falls away, there's, of course, the experience is one of great peace, actually. Great peace. Lack of division. Psychologically, lack of division. And what self-consciousness then reflects upon is this lack of division. So your sense of your own being is no longer the ego which fell away, but it becomes like this empty center, this aware empty space. And initially that aware empty space may seem quite, well, empty. But when it really reveals itself, which again, you can't make happen, it reveals itself when we're ready for it to reveal itself. When it reveals itself, that the empty center reveals itself to be divine. I don't mean as a philosophy or a theology of divinity. I mean it's experienced as divine, as almost the source of all life, of something of extraordinary meaning, although you can never verbalize what the meaning is, of extraordinary significance, of its to be unified within, and your experience of withinness is that of a kind of divinity. Whatever you want to call that divinity. And so now self, the act of self, which is just self-reflection, which used to look upon the ego, now the ego's not there. Then there's kind of an emptiness that might start out as quite empty, but then reveals itself to be divine, to be kind of an infinite ground of being, you could say. One could go on describing all this forever, but each person has to experience it for themselves. So this becomes one's experience, one's inner experience. And of course, when that becomes mature, then that sense of divinity, that sense of wholeness or completeness, then you see that that divinity, when you look what we call out upon the world, you see or intuit that same divinity in everything, so that everything you see, you know in a very concrete way, obvious way. You experience, you know that everything and everyone is that divinity. No matter what they're experiencing, no matter what they're going through, no matter what form it takes, a human being, a cloud, a rock, a forest, a wave, ocean, mountain, lake, you know, can of garbage in the city, all the same. I mean, there's a sense of that divinity everywhere. And of course, that often starts out as quite, has an astounding quality to begin with, because it's new, because you have, because it's, whenever anything's new, it has an astounding quality. It's because you have some reference to some old way of being. But as that really matures, the astounding quality of divinity starts to lessen and lessen and lessen. It lessens because there's no reflection on what it's not. In other words, an older state of consciousness, you kind of forget it. It just drops into, you know, a history that doesn't even seem like it happened almost. And now this, the divinity inside and outside becomes more of just your lived reality. Again, it takes on a kind of normalcy. Everybody thinks that they'll be walking around in ecstasy all the time. Well, you might experience moments of ecstasy, but ecstasy is really, it's not what we're talking about here. There can be moments like that, days, weeks, months, who knows? But essentially, it's, as this becomes more and more mature, you realize that divinity transcends all of your experiences of it. So you can have some great ecstasy, let's say, but at a point of spiritual maturity, you no longer mistake your ecstasy for God, in other words. Ecstasy is simply one form that it took for a moment, or an hour, or a month, or whoever, however long, or some other experience. This is one of the more challenging parts of this experience for the people who go through it, is clinging to spiritual experience, mistaking spiritual experiences of reality for reality itself. But they're your experiences of reality. They're not reality itself. So in other words, let's say you light a match. You touch the flame with your finger. When you touch the flame with your finger, it hurts your finger. To you, the flame is hot. Ouch. It burns you. That's your experience of the flame. But that's not the flame's experiences of the flame. The flame doesn't experience itself as ouch. You experience the flame as ouch when you put your finger in it. And in a similar way, our experiences, all these, you know, spiritual experiences that some people have, and if you don't have a lot of them, don't think you're missing anything. It just means you have less to let go of. If you're kind of hooked up to have a rich diversity of spiritual experiences, that's fine. But at some point, you have to realize that you're clinging to those rich diversity of spiritual experiences. Actually, in the final say of all things, actually ends up to provide a kind of subtle separation. In other words, there's still you as a self, your self's experience of reality rather than reality's experience of itself, you could say. It's like when you meet another person. Hello, how are you, you say, and you talk to them and they tell you, you share your stories and or your viewpoints or whatever, you're getting to know somebody. Your experience of them is not who they are. Your experience of them is your experience of them. It's not the same as who they are. It's your experience of who they are. Your experience of who someone is very different as their experience of who they are. And this is one of the things we're always mistaking our experience for something or someone, for what something or someone actually is. And we forget that, no, what something or someone actually is completely different than my experience of them or it. When you start to kind of get on to this, it can be disappointing, let's say. Because for a long, long time, you know, we make this fundamental error of thinking that our experience of things is what they are. And we take this right into spirituality, and we think my experience of divinity, my experience of God or the truth is what the truth or God or divinity is. So, I mean, at this level, it's all very lovely and it's all very good because the experiences are quite unified and seamless and by and large quite lovely. They mature into something that's quite ordinary. Again, when they mature into something quite ordinary, all this can happen for you, once again, without anybody knowing that anything happened for you. They may notice, they may not notice. Even if they notice, they probably won't know what's actually happening. But again, the proof of all this isn't necessarily in what you see from the outside. Of course, if the person, if you're still going around acting like an egoic, obsessed neurotic, then, well, one hasn't really experienced the depth that we're really talking about now. Now, when I'm using the term no self, the experience of no self, it is when this looking within, which is what self-consciousness is. So when I'm using the word self, again, I'm using the word self not as an entity or as a thing or as somebody, although you may mistake it as that. But self is in its seed form, in its essence, self is the act or the verb of self-consciousness. Self looking within. No longer having an ego, a divided ego, but having a more quiet, unified experience, quiet, silent, unified. Now, when self-consciousness stops, in other words, so there's no reference within anymore. This is impossible to describe, really, although I try. But the act of self-consciousness was to cease. It doesn't mean that you wouldn't see anything or hear anything or taste anything or feel anything. It doesn't mean that you'd fall into some state of unconsciousness. It's that you'd fall into a state of unself-consciousness. And now this kind of self, now remember, it's not a self that's reflecting upon the ego. That's egoic consciousness. This is a self that's very, feels very open and free and spacious and in a certain sense divine. And then that act ceases. Again, one can't say why. And self-consciousness can't stop being self-conscious. Everything self-consciousness does to not be self-conscious is an act of self-consciousness. You see, so it kind of wraps itself up. But, of course, that doesn't mean also that there's nothing to do. There's nothing for you to do. There's no participation. It doesn't mean that either. That's where we get into the realm of all these sort of experiences that get translated into sort of silly philosophies and theologies that just spin into all sorts of ridiculous kinds of discussions, at least as far as I'm concerned, which means they spin very far away from actual experience. None of that is what I'm interested in here. I'm not interested in creating a new, you know, theology or idea or I'm trying to describe something from an experiential point of view, knowing that the mind can only take this as a set of ideas unless you're experiencing it. But nonetheless, we all do the best we can, you and I together, don't we? So, no self does not mean a better self. When ego drops away, it feels like no self, but what you're actually experiencing is no ego, but you actually got a better self, a self that's divine, a self that's infinite, a self that you may actually see and experience everywhere and as everything. But is essentially a kind of profound stillness and quietness and emptiness. And experience of no self is that in a negative way of talking about it. It's hard to talk about it in a positive way. I'll give it a try in a moment. But in a negative way of talking about it, it's the cessation of that kind of self-consciousness, which again doesn't mean, I think, what our minds might immediately think it means. It doesn't mean we become suddenly blank out or pass out because we're not conscious. You know, self-consciousness is just a particular type of consciousness. We can't understand it until it's not there anymore. It's kind of like ego. You can't really fully understand ego until it's not there anymore. Then you understand it. Self is the same way. We can't really completely understand it experientially until it's not there. And then we understand it because we know, well, okay, it was what's no longer there. That's what it was. Then the understanding of it is quite obvious. It's quite simple. Of course, when you describe it, it seems quite complex, I imagine. So when self falls away, there's no alternative identity. It's not exchanging in a little identity for a big identity or an egoic identity for a divine identity. No self means essentially not a new identity. No identity. It's hard to think of... Here's where all the language breaks down, isn't it? It's hard to think of oneself in any other terms other than a self, and also to think in oneself in any other terms in an identity. Because up to that point, it's basically an expansion and a transparency of identity. We start with an egoic identity, small, very well defined, even if it's very chaotic and obvious. Then maybe our identity goes to kind of a vast state. Okay, then we'll say, I am awareness. Awareness is something that's very transparent. It's not like an ego. It's not a thing. It's very transparent. It's very quiet. It's very unified. It's very whole. And the deep surface experience of awareness as being the awareness of other things. So, you know, that thought's not awareness, or my foot's not awareness, or the wall over there is not awareness. The awareness is the knowing of all that. That's relatively surface. When we have a very deep experience of awareness, well, then awareness, it sees itself as everything that it's aware of. That's also another identity, though, you see. So spirituality, in one sense, is going from a less true identity, which the less true the identity is, the more dense and confined and solid it feels. The more true the identity is, the less confined, the less solid, the less defined that it is, until identity finally just drops away entirely. And in that, one can't say anything, you see, because all statements then are kind of identity statements. They're claims, they're definitions. But in real no self, the real experience of no self is there's no claim. There's no I am this, I am that. There's no claim. There's no identity. There's no description. Although there is an absolute obviousness of what it is. In a certain sense, you know, one of the ways I've put it before is when the infinite knows itself, recognizes itself, but not as an act of self-consciousness, not as something, not as an experience, and not as a new identity. And that is something that's not even conceivable to the way our mind's hooked up. It's not conceivable. Unfortunately, when we run into something that's not conceivable, the mind starts to form a new ideology, a new philosophy about it, instead of staying with the fact that is what is beyond self is not conceivable to self or ego or mind. It's just not. No matter how subtle the philosophy, no matter how intricate the explanations, in the same way that, you know, my description of it now is not the same thing as the falling away of self. I hope you can begin to see, however, that there's a trajectory here. This all occurs kind of on a spectrum. From dense, contracted identity of ego to more subtle, more transparent identity, which is more unified until it gets almost entirely unified, seeing itself as everywhere and everything. And then that last act of self-consciousness, seeing itself that way, falls away. And there is the infinite experiencing itself or knowing itself. One of the few people that has written about this with any kind of clarity, I think, great, one of my favorite mystics, Meister Eckhart. And Meister Eckhart, he talked about knowing that you can only truly, fully know God from God's point of view. To know God, you have to be God, but not be God as a new identity, not to run around thinking or feeling even, I am God. Because I am God is lovely, it's a great experience, it's a nice state of consciousness, but in the end, it's just another state of consciousness. That's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about taking on a new identity. What he's saying is that the difference between ego or self knowing God and God's knowing of God are completely two different things. And most all of his own theology was written from that standpoint, as it were, of almost of the infinite, or what he'd called the Godhead, looking back and then describing how it sees the intricacies of the human experience. So this whole journey, though, if we can even call it a journey, goes on this spectrum beyond identity. And as I said, as soon as we go beyond identity, then we run out of descriptions. We're out of the realm of description. We're out of the realm of identity. That's the difficulty of it. That's where I always kind of stammer, and that's not describable. And again, one of the great barriers to all this is all the projections of our mind that our mind has. It thinks to recognize this as, you know, one has to look a particular way, have a certain kind of spiritual hue about them or atmosphere, or, you know, there's just endless ways that the mind imagines of what all this is going to be like, instead of just confessing that it can't possibly know. Until it does. Now, I've gone over a whole lot tonight. I told you the first night was going to be probably the most intense, the most difficult in a certain sense. I know I've talked for nearly an hour and a half. That's a lot to ask anybody to listen to, especially when we're talking about something as sort of subtle, beyond the conceptual mind and beyond even, explanation. That's a lot to ask of anybody. So if it's been difficult to follow, I apologize. I've done the best I could so far. There's, you know, much more to this. We'll unfold this over the ensuing 3 weeks. I think I'll open up. We have about a half an hour or so. If anybody wants to call for any clarifications on what I've talked about this evening, the phone lines, will open them up now. They're on your computer screen. The international number is 408-938-0476. The U.S. and Canada number is 1-800-997-7182. Those numbers are on your computer screen. If you want to call and ask about any of this, and again, I'm putting this in a particular language. This could be put in a number of different ways of speaking about it. I could describe it from probably a little different points of view experientially. But I've tried to put it in the most undramatic, simple, and I think the most honest way, at least to this point, that I can really describe it as. But like I said, I hope you get some real feeling of, so whether this, any part of this is your experience from where we started to where we ended up, but there, this is the spectrum, this is the trajectory, this is really experientially what letting go means and what it leads to, what surrender means and what it leads to, what waking up means and what it leads to. The idea that, you know, every moment of awakening is the same. It's not. there, as you could see, there's different kinds of awakenings on this spectrum. And it's easy to mistake one for the other. It's very easy to make that mistake. And I think that happens a lot today, that this mistake, it all gets sort of condensed down into to one thing. And by condensing it down into one thing, that may make things sound and feel very, very simple and nice and tidy. But if that's our conclusion, that, you know, every moment of awakening is like every other moment of awakening, then we could actually be putting a block in right in front of our own development, our own complete unfolding. It would just be like saying that, you know, every experience of ego is like every other experience of ego. That somebody that's that's a pathological liar is exactly the same as someone that is altruistic and very loving and compassionate being. They might both exist on the spectrum of ego, but I would suggest that, you know, someone that's pathologically, narcissistically self-obsessed is very different in the egoic spectrum than somebody who's altruistic, loving, compassionate, and not self-obsessed. You could collapse it all down and say it's all ego, but that wouldn't be to tell the whole story, would it? There's a spectrum that ego exists on. There's a spectrum that spiritual awakening takes place on. And when we collapse everything down and just say, well, if you've had a moment of aha, then that's it, boy, you've completely arrived. If we just accept that, or that's what we think, that conclusion can really get in our way. Not that one should keep striving for more and more. This isn't about striving. This isn't about hearing what I'm saying, for instance, and saying, I want that. Because that would be to substitute somebody else's truth for your own. Wherever we are in our own unfolding is perfectly adequate. Our own intuition of what we yearn for or what we're called to is reality speaking to us individually and perfectly. And if we try to take somebody else's, you know, thing and put it on top of that, then we're not listening to how the infinite talks to us and how it leads us along, how its wisdom informs us. So that's, of course, the danger of any explanation like that, is it gets people to, number one, to assess where they are on the spectrum, and then to, you know, oh, well, I want to be there. I'm not satisfied with being here, you know, and then to have all these projections about what they want to, and it all gets into this murky, abstract realm of, you know, grasping and seeking. But can we just collectively acknowledge that tendency if it's there in anyone? Can we see that kind of tendency to always be, you know, grasping at something that's beyond our own current level of unfolding simply gets in our way? That reality or life, the infinite, call you what it will, God, has a way of leading us in just the perfect way, if we will only just listen to it inside. So I would hope that through anything in this course, it doesn't make you then start to strive for something new or different or better. Because I think by now you might have an idea what it is that would be doing that. as I said, one of the reasons I want to bring forth some of this teaching is because there are more people that are moving into the deeper realms of this spectrum of awakening. And yes, it is, it's not like, you know, nobody writes about it well or nobody speaks about it well. It's hard to find. It's difficult to find. You don't find it all over the place. In fact, what you find all over the place is a lot of stuff that actually often doesn't help when you get to a deeper point in this spectrum of awakening. It can actually get in the way. And so, and also because, as I said, people are experiencing this more. And again, we can have transcendent or peak moments where we can go way beyond our current development, you could say. You can just fly to something, you know, all the way to no self, you might say. You may or may not be able to sustain that. That may be an experiencing that for a moment even can be and will be a very important part and introduce a whole different kind of energy and movement into your own awakening. So it's not just like it's necessarily, you know, graduate you this and then this and then this and then this. At any point, you know, you can go from A to Z at any instant. More often than not, you know, you can go from A to Z, but you usually come there somewhere in between. But going A to Z, Z will have a profound influence on your own unfolding then. You know, every once in a blue moon, someone goes from A to Z and stays there. Okay? Happens every once in a blue moon. Not very often, though. So, let's see. Great. Let's go to Katie and Marin. Hi, welcome.
Hi, Adia.
Hey.
Hi, I have a practical question of what you've been speaking about. Is there a physical component or a calibration?
Oh, absolutely.
And what is that? I'd like pointers to sort of gauge what to look at things that are happening to me to say, well, okay, I can see how this is tying into this experience, or it has nothing to do with this experience.
Well, I mean, in any kind of spiritual, real and spiritual unfolding, almost at any part of the spectrum that I talked about, you know, once we start to move beyond the strictly defined egoic state,
right. There
is always, it's always accompanied, at least for a certain time, with there's great physical adjustments. There's often great openings of energy, raw energy, right? I imagine you've had those experiences. You know, sometimes those, you can all get into all the sort of integral philosophy of all that kundalini energy and everything, but I just like to kind of stay with the experiential aspect and just say,
exactly,
there's a raw energy that gets released because what we don't know is that it's not that that energy wasn't there, is that it was all contracted into and conflicted into maintaining that tight egoic structure. It's almost like, you know, when you split an atom. When you split
it. Well, exactly.
Yeah, it releases huge energy.
Yeah, that's been an experience. And then there's the physical pain, and then there's the disorientation, even that off balance.
Yes, you can
literally can't. But the calibration, is there signposts to this particular experience of the dropping away of self maybe I'm still dealing with that, but I don't know, maybe I'm anticipating
For each person it's different, right? So each person has their own version. For some people, the adjustments, physical, mental, intellectual, brain chemistry, nervous system. For some people, it's relatively small. For some people, it's just enormous and extraordinarily difficult. And most people are somewhere in between. It's very common that, at any point in this spectrum, almost that it plays havoc with. Often, it plays havoc with memory. It plays havoc sometimes with literally your balance for a while.
Exactly.
With your whole system, because each time we shift consciousness, literally even our physicality, the body is, it becomes oriented to each state of consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. Your whole nervous system, your brain chemistry, everything orients itself to your state of consciousness. Now, your state of consciousness shifts, and it throws that whole orientation out of whack. Because it's all of a sudden there's something new, and it's like, wait a minute, the old way that everything about you oriented itself is suddenly gone. It's shifted. And that can be, you know, and that can, it can take, and it does take a while, and often, many cases, years, for your system to reorganize. And this says nothing about the fact that also there will almost always be, when certain things open, it will put pressure on physical areas that are still blocked or contracted. So, you know, you can walk around with, I'm not trying to scare anybody, but I decided when I was going to do this course that I was simply going to tell the truth, and no matter if it scared people or not. So not everybody has all these symptoms, but it's not, some people have, for like I had, you know, these horrendous headaches.
Horrendous.
Oh, just horrendous.
Yeah, neck
aches. Yeah, right up.
Going around. Frozen. Oh,
awful.
Yes. Awful.
Yeah, like almost like they would probably be classified as different kinds of migraines, but that no amount of pain medicine can touch.
Right.
Yeah, and these are, you know, this is that kind of immense energy moving through constriction, right? And this of course can create different kinds of physical pains and you know, and some of it, you know, you can, you know, there are of course some of the more esoteric forms of yogic systems were meant to deal with some of this, you know, different kinds of breathing and postures and all that kind of stuff. I find that you got to be really, you got to really kind of be careful about what you do, because you got to really feel your own way with what helps and what harms.
Right.
Because sometimes you're doing something to help open something up, but actually it's making your energy actually more, it's making it greater and greater and greater.
More
and
intense.
Yeah. So a lot of times people are going, well, I'm doing, you know, I go do Qigong or I go to my yoga class, but it just wigs my energy out. It just gets it like a flame. And so you've got to really kind of find your way with.
And so you can't look at that and say, "Oh, well, this is working. This is helping work it through." It's actually creating more.
You have to be very practical about it. In other words, you know, if you got sort of more pain, more disorientation, more, that's like, well, maybe what I'm doing isn't helping. You know,
right.
If you know, so sometimes doing less is more. That's something that a lot of people miss. A lot of very normal activities actually sometimes are what is needed, like, you know, working in the garden, going for lots of walks, you know, these very ordinary kind of simple things sometimes are more called for than all the esoteric spiritual stuff.
Is there an aspect of going, like, talking to doctors and things, and they're telling you about your neurotransmitters being off or your hormones and things.
Yeah.
I almost feel like supplements and these things that are pointing to getting those back in balance, mm-hmm. almost feels like I'm reconstituting some sort of identity instead of just letting it fall away.
Well, I mean, again, you have to follow. I would never want to, you know, tell someone not to go to a doctor and not to, you know. I mean, I've had lots of people that I know, they'll go to the doctor and they'll say, you got to do a brain scan and see if I have Alzheimer's, my memory's not, you know. And,
exactly.
And, you know, usually they don't find anything. But this kind of energy can throw your hormonal system completely out of balance. It can throw your brain chemistry,
right.
Quite out. I remember I literally had, and I didn't do this because of, you know, I was concerned, but actually this sort of naturopathic doctor I was going to just kind of wanted to do it out of interest. Let's see what's going on in your brain chemistry, you know, and they did these tests, you know, I can't even remember what they were. And they were like,
And
I remember we were sitting back in his office and I knew him very well. He's kind of a friend of mine. And so we were talking and he sort of leaned back in his chair and he just started laughing as he was looking at this. And he said, Adya, this is the strangest thing. He goes, you have the brain chemistry of somebody who's probably suicidally depressed and anxious and everything. And he says, but as far as I can see, you're not depressed. You're not anxious. In fact, you seem to be, you know, very happy and doing really quite well. And I said, yeah, I'm doing fantastically well. And that's why he was laughing, because, you know, it just, he couldn't make sense of it. I mean, that was years ago when I was, you know, much more of the energetic stuff was going on and probably throwing all that chemistry off. It may have all balanced now. I don't know. I never even sort of checked later, but it can certainly throw out whether trying to put that in balance with supplements and stuff like that is a good idea. I wouldn't even want to say whether it is or it isn't, except you'd have to find your own way. I mean, if you felt like you were getting really, really out of balance, then yeah, then something's...
It doesn't feel... You know, it feels out of balance with the norm,
yeah.
But it doesn't feel out of balance for me.
Yeah, good.
And even
okay.
when I don't feel good,
yeah,
I want to, and maybe this is my story, attribute it to this process.
Well,
and so I'm much
yeah.
more allowing of it.
Yeah.
But then I get, whether it's outside influences
yeah.
or comparing...
Yeah.
And saying, uh-oh, something's wrong.
Yeah.
When I lose that. And
yeah.
I don't want to. I want to trust that. You, and I don't need to tell anybody else. And
yeah.
I want to be able to tell myself, no, you are going through this opening, this experience.
Yeah, well, you know it's you're going different. Through something, right? You know that.
Right.
So that,
right.
And that's definitely have an effect on your physicality. You know that.
Right.
That much you know. You know, like I said, beyond that, I find that often people's deep intuition is a pretty good thing to go by. You know, of course, we could take it to the extreme, and there you are suffering from some real illness that you could actually get some real help with, and you're just thinking it's all spiritual. People can kind of go off
right.
the beam, you know, spiritualizing everything. But that's not what I'm really hearing in what you're saying. That's not what I'm feeling.
It's more of an out of balance, but I realized
yeah.
what I'm waking up from was being so out of balance.
Yeah.
That the disorientation is actually pushing me back towards balance.
It's almost always a part of your entire system. And like I said, this goes down to right down to, you know, very measurable physical stuff, you know, your hormone levels, your brain chemistry, all that stuff. A change of consciousness, everything reorients, and it would be nice if it just sort of went like click right into place.
Right, right.
And every once in a blue moon it happens that way, but for the other 99% of us, I kind of think of it almost more like if you had a can of Coca-Cola that you walked around with you shaking your entire life, and then you finally, you know, crack the top off of it.
Exactly.
It's not just going to go like, psst.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's going to blast out, and that's going to be part of it coming back down and then finding its way.
Right.
Yeah.
But you talked about explosive experiences of energy during your purging and during your, when you're, it's like putting your finger over the hose.
Yeah.
But is there markers specifically to the dropping away of self?
The dropping away of self specifically, well, because they can look so much like other markers.
Or does that matter?
It doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't really matter, actually, because, like I said, you can have. There are no markers that I think that are specifically the dropping away of self. Not specifically. Necessarily. No, that only pertain when self drops away. No, I mean, there are certain, I wouldn't even say psychological things, but there is a kind of, these aren't like body adjustments necessarily. They may be strange adjustments psychologically, but it is like, the best way I've ever described it is, which was unsettling to the person I described it, but it was also intriguing to them, which was, it's the falling away of your inner life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, however you define your inner life, it could be psychologically, spiritually, your inner life, period. There's nothing exempt. So good inner life isn't exempt. your falling away of your inner life is really the most, I think, accurate description of what no self is all about. Falling away of your inner life, whether it's the egoic life, the divinity life, the oneness life, all that inner stuff.
The striving and the identification with being,
yeah.
Or becoming.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and it's also the falling away of identification, like I said, this spectrum from contracted identification to very transparent and unified and very spiritual identification, and then identification ceasing. That's what I mean by sort of the dropping away of one's inner life. So, of course, it becomes quiet, but it's not the kind of quiet that the self turns into when it's in the state that's beyond ego. When the state is beyond ego, when you turn within, it's very quiet, right? But it's a kind of quiet that you notice by turning within. This other kind of quiet is there's no turning within.
Well, what you said is it's ordinary.
Yes.
It feels so natural.
Yes,
it's
completely.
It's like, wait, what? This is the most ordinary thing in the world. Everything else was abnormal.
Yes. Yes.
Everything else I've done is this is so ordinary.
Yes, I think that's probably one of the surprising things about it. It's so natural, so ordinary. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. It's not to be defined by any of those spiritual experiences we read in books, or that we have some people have along the way. It is a profound kind of ordinariness. Yeah. And we realize that ordinary everyday life and everything that's in everyday ordinary life is it.
Is it. Is it.
And all the rest of the stuff was either ego or self created.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ordinary life is it. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So those are the shifts that... Yeah, that I mean, that are obviously we're talking
beginning
about.
Beginning to nowhere.
Yeah,
nowhere,
how each body responds
moment.
To that is very,
right.
You know, is very. That's the problem with, you know, you read one person's story and then you read some, and it's, you know, they can be very, very, for one person, you know, it's this sort of wild, you know, roller coaster ride getting there. For somebody else, it's totally different. So we each have our, and the way our bodies
and
respond is totally
so
different.
Jarring for me is that I was the roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
And now when it stops, I'm like, oh, you're just off the roller coaster.
That's right.
You're just off the roller coaster.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Because there can be identity derived from the high points of the roller coaster.
Oh, or the low points.
Or the, well, especially the low points, but then later the high points. Yeah. 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 Yeah, so really that the intuition, I think, is a really important thing to, is a really important thing to trust, you know? And I've even had the question, I mean, I think even physically, since not that many people historically have, you know, bumped into this, although more are recently, you know, our physical bodies have not actually had to adapt to this. Do you know?
Yeah, you
over
don't
the
know
centuries.
What to do.
Yeah, yeah. This is all pretty, pretty new stuff. It's like a new environment to be thrust into. And, you know, everybody's bodies respond to it quite differently. But it's definitely it's an adjustment in almost every case.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, well, I took a long time there. Well, we still got 15 minutes, so we should be able to get to the last two. Let's go to, let's see. I hope I say your name right. Is it Lode in Amsterdam?
That's right. We talked once before.
Yes, we did. I think I asked you the same question, didn't I? About your name.
You did. All right.
Yeah.
I have a pretty... practical question. Last time it was kind of philosophical when we talked about the symbolism of the whole Jesus story being about us. Okay, this is more practical. So looking at it from the point of view of who we truly are, of course, compared to that, what we seem to be doing and seem to be as humans is not really what we are, right?
No.
So I was wondering if you would think that the following sentence could be helpful to as a reminder now and then throughout the day, you know, when we forget. Okay, the sentence is, let's see. I am that indescribably great charity watching this, which I am not doing, and I am not.
Boy, if you can remember that.
Well, yeah, I can.
Yeah.
I'm that indescribably great charity watching this, which I'm not doing, and I'm not.
I suppose it's as good as any.
There's now and then, right? There's now and then, this reminder. And then even watch this thought. So that kind of like fades away too, right? Of course, everything.
Okay, everything. So everything you might do or every teaching or every technique is useful or not useful depending on specifically where you are, right?
Yeah.
So I would say for specifically where you are, this is perfectly fine, this affirmation, if you give much more emphasis to what the affirmation invokes in you, not intellectually but experientially.
Right, the watching.
Yeah, the watching. And feel into that and sense into that much more so than even more so than defining yourself as that. I mean, the affirmation may start that way, but then you're really just feeling into that and once it helps you reconnect with an intuitive sense of being beyond your mind, then that reconnection is really all you need. At that point, that's all you need. Then you stay with the experience and you can drop the affirmation.
Right.
Or the statement.
It's just like, let's say the car stopped again and you remember, oh, wait a minute. So you're sticking the key, turn it, and then after that, you don't have to think about the key anymore because the car's already running then.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. My only caution would be you just don't turn the key into the truth.
No.
Right?
Right, of course.
Because eventually,
it's a crutch.
Everything's a crutch, and it's perfectly fine to use crutches. That's what spiritual teachings are, aren't they?
Right.
They're crutches, but that's
kids using these bikes, they have these little side wheels, but once they can go without them, of course, you take them off.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, great.
All right, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. All right. That's great. Anybody that's listened to me or my teaching or probably read, but you probably get more of the sense when you listen to me over a period of time is I think there's a usefulness of, you know, being very open and open to direction from somebody you really trust. You know, could be me, could be somebody else. But what I really, really want to foster in people is there's this sort of intuitive capacity. As I said, the way that the infinite or God or life speaks to you and shows you just the next thing, give you just the next sense of the next moment of direction, and you just accept it, you take it to heart, you utilize it, but you don't deify it in the sense that you don't hold on to it as absolute, as some absolute truth or something you do forever, but you just see it that that moment you're given something that if it's given to you in the way I'm talking about, and you really utilize it, it can be very powerful. And that kind of attunement to a kind of inner direction is just at least as important as being open and available to direction or suggestion from outside. you know, and what might really resonate or work with one person for the next person does not work. That's why when I describe different kind of spiritual techniques I do, like in the book, The Way of Liberation, that probably a lot of you have. If you don't, you can go to the website and you can download it for free, or you can buy it as a hard copy. But there's the there's basically this certain kind of what might be called spiritual practices, but they're not overly defined. They're not like A, B, C, D, E. It's kind of like they're stated, but you have to get a sense, you have to get a feel, you have to find out how your own intuitive guidance works with those practices in a way that it starts to inform you from the inside. Because you can't just apply a given teaching from some like in a cookie cutter way. You know, if it happens to resonate for you at a particular fine time, great. But there's no teaching that you can use like a cookie cutter for everybody. In the end, we have to develop that intuitive capacity, discriminating and wise, yes, but also intuitive capacity to listen very deeply, which really means a capacity to listen, to be quiet, to be patient, so that we can feel and intuit the way that life, or God as you will, wants to reveal itself to you. So, let's see. John from California. Hi, welcome, John.
Hi, Ajahn.
Hi.
I wanted to ask, the no-self, can it be non-abiding? Can there be periodic experiences of it?
Yes. Like I said, you can jump from A to Z at any moment. At any moment, you can kind of, or I sometimes call it a foretaste. Yes, that's absolutely possible. And in fact, it often happens that way for a while. Hold on, John, I can't hear you.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Okay, John, go ahead. Pardon me.
The no self is kind of like nothing. It's not an experience.
Right. It's not an experience. It starts out as nothing because that's the first thing that. Well, even though we say it's not an experience, pardon me, we run to the limits of language. But even though we say it's not an experience, but the first part of the no-self experience is that kind of nothingness. As it is, when we start to go beyond ego, we often experience a kind of nothingness there as well. So that's why I say the two are often mistaken as the same thing. But in the no-self experience, there is a kind of non-experiential nothingness, which what we're really experiencing is the nothingness of consciousness no longer being self-conscious, no longer reflecting back. And so there's nothing for it to look at. That's the experience of nothingness is sort of one of the first indications that consciousness is no longer doing this sort of self-reflective movement, right?
It's almost as if there's no inside or outside.
That's right. There is no inside or outside then. There is no insight. Self-reflective consciousness or self-consciousness creates the experience of both inside and outside. And when that stops, there's no experience of inside or outside, as you say. For as long as it stops, there's no experience of in or out. Yeah. And if there's no inside, then there's no inner life. Of course, the question then at some point arises is, okay, what is there in the absence of self? At first, we often just experience the absence. And when I say just, I don't mean to underestimate it. But we experience the absence, the great absence of self-consciousness. But what is there then in the absence of that? So what, in other words, what does that absence end up revealing? But to really just answer the question that you first started is yes, we very much can at any point go right to a non-egoic state or a non-self state. And very often people have one or many, many glimpses like that or experiences that last for, you know, seconds, minutes, hours, days, sometimes weeks, only to kind of seemingly fall away. It's very common for people to go right into that state, sure, at any point along the way. People can drop into a complete no-self state that have no interest in spirituality whatsoever. Yeah. Okay?
Okay. Thank you, Ajahn.
You're welcome, John. Thanks for calling. Yeah. Yeah. You know, my favorite example of this was many years ago when somebody had a very profound experience, revelation of no self, and they came to me actually wanting to ask me how they could get their self back. You know, they weren't spiritual. They weren't seeking it. They never heard about it. They didn't care at all about spirituality or religion or anywhere. All of a sudden, one day, it just fell away. And, you know, you can imagine if you have zero context and the whole thing just falls away one day, well, it can be quite disconcerting. It can be quite confusing. It can be even more disorienting than it usually is. And so I've met a number of people over the years that have had that kind of experience happen, and they've basically come to me to help bring a kind of context to what's happening, because it's not true that you would think if one just fell into that complete no-self state, it's not really a state, but again, pardon my language, if we really fell into it, then there would be automatically a complete comprehension of it. But that's simply not the case. People can fall into that and not know what in the hell happened. People can fall into that and be quite confused about what happened. They can, you know... And so that's part of bringing some of this context to the fore also, is sometimes if someone's really experiencing that, some context, because you still do, you know, have a mind, even though it can be, it tends to go very quiet. But if the mind has no context, no contextual understanding of what's happening, the mind actually can be quite active, scrambling to wonder what just happened to me. You know, I mean, there have been people that have been, in, you know, gone for years wondering what has happened to me. So you don't always get a profound understanding about what's happened to you simply because it's happened. As I said, it's another reason I'm bringing some of this, trying to bring some of this forth. I want to also say it's the sort of the end of our time together. And this is probably not a great, not way great place to end it on, but nonetheless, I wanted to bring it out that, you know, anything in life, everything we do, from walking down the street to getting in your car to getting in a plane to riding a bicycle to walking down the sidewalk, has risks. Spirituality and spiritual unfolding is not without its risks. It has risks. You know, one, the greatest risk is the ego hijacks the whole project. That's a great risk. As I said, we often undergo great physical sort of energetic changes. If our egoic mind is very fractured already, very, very, very divisive, sometimes it works out absolutely fine. Sometimes it's extraordinarily divisive. You throw this powerful, you know, if you blast open beyond the ego or have self drop away entirely, that fractured mental state if it's too fractured, can actually become more fractured. As again, there are dangers in all this, like there are in anything else in life. Spirituality is not like anything else in life. I wouldn't say the dangers are any greater than in anything else you do. But I do think it's worthwhile to say. And if those of you who've had, you know, really, really difficult backgrounds, there's often fear in your system. And of course, with certain kinds of openings, that kind of fear, most people will experience fear anyway. Even people that had wonderful backgrounds or upbringings, they'll often experience a kind of fear. Not everybody, but majority of people do. So if someone even with a fairly nice upbringing stuff will experience fear, often in these kind of openings, if you've had a really difficult time of it, you already carry around a fair amount of fear. And of course, fear tends to build on fear, right? One opening of fear tends to trigger another opening of fear. So one has to be a little, just proceed with a kind of compassion for yourself and recognize that it's important that when you begin to open, that you can't necessarily control it, but you can, in a certain sense, you can modulate it. You can back away if it seems to be unfolding way faster than you can really integrate and control. You got to really be connected with yourself and really be honest with what you feel you can integrate and how fast you can integrate it, you know? If someone's in the old days, if you're at a Zen monastery and if someone started to experience something that threw them very, very much out of balance, you know, they would take them away from all spiritual practice, all spiritual teachings, and they'd just put them in the garden and have them hoeing and digging and planting vegetables and pulling weeds and to get them out of that environment to allow things to settle back down again to the point where they're ready to kind of come back in to engage in their spiritual lives in a more direct way again. So there has to be a kind of wisdom about this, you know. And again, sometimes there's not a deep enough understanding of this, you know. Sometimes you hear in spiritual teachings, well, if you experience fear, just jump in, you know, take a swan dive into your fear. You know, if the fear is just that existential fear of non-existence, okay. But if that fear of non-existence is all mixed up with a whole bunch of other preceding fears over, you know, from whatever their cause may be, someone takes a swan dive into that, they might just take a swan dive and find themselves quite over their head. So you have to, again, that's why I always come back to these two parts of the teaching, which are you have to kind of bring a sense of your own intuitive sense of good sense. Do you know? Your own sense of good sense, of really listening inside to always feel what's really enough or too much for you, what's working or not working for you, to really have a deep sense of that and also have a kind of compassion, you know, because, you know, one doesn't really even need to be overly cavalier about all this. There's a kind of compassion and love that really takes into account the entirety of whatever your human experience is. And, you know, life is perfectly okay that you unfold in just the way that's just right for you, that's just in the right timing, in the right way, where you're not trying to push things all the time. There's no need to push anything. Things have a way of opening in a way that's much more holistic and integratable, to make up a word, integratable when you approach this with a bit of your own intuitive wisdom and a real sense of compassion and love for your own humanness, your own humanity. So I just want to say that this goes the true with any spiritual teaching. You know, is those components of your human experience are very, very important to pay attention to. So it's really lovely and a delight to be sharing this with you and exploring this with you. And as I said, I hope you will just take all this in easily. You don't have to understand each point of it. You know, you don't have to remember each point of it. I said the audio will be there to listen to it again, but more to get a sense of it, more to get a sense of it. And for those of you who certain parts of this really resonate, and I hope this will be a useful context. And we're just getting started. We'll explore much more of this as time goes on during this course, because there's almost an unfathomable depth to all this. There's an unfathomable depth to your own being, to our own being. And this is why we're all gathered here together. So, thank you for joining me this evening. Be well until we're together again next week. Namaste. Thank you.